This show furnished by Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn. It's time for Gervey's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervey. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervey and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening around the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervey, and I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here on this beautiful Saturday afternoon to be the managing partner of your life. And I am flying solo today. My co-host, the beautiful Carrie Kasem, is on assignment, so she's not here with me. But we have a great show lined up. And I really want to tell you, we have a full docket. We got so much happening today, and I got to get right into it. But before I do, I want to just put a plug in for next week's show, because it's next week. Next Sunday is Father's Day, and we have a special Father's Day show right here on Gervey's Law, Everything Legal. We are scheduled to have LeVar Ball on our show for Father's Day. The Father of the Year, I would say, for Lonzo Ball, of course. Lonzo Ball, the UCLA basketball player who most likely will be taken by the LA Lakers, number two in the draft. And LeVar has been outspoken, and he is supposed to join us on a special Father's Day show, and we'll find some legal connection. I know he's got some company going on, and there's some contracts that I'm sure will be negotiated with Lonzo once he becomes an LA Laker or some other, drafted by some other team. And also on the show on Father's Day, we're going to talk to Brett Haley, who is a filmmaker who came out with a film called The Hero, starring Sam Elliott. And it details an interesting story of a father and a daughter. And again, we will find legal connections, because that's what we do right here on Gervey's Law. We have legal connections. Today, we have a lot of legal connections, because we're going to start the show off talking to Richard Druyan, who is a former chief assistant United States attorney, and he was former chief of criminal division of the United States Attorney's Office. We're going to talk about James Comey's testimony. You might have heard of that. It occurred this past week, and we're going to talk about the implications it might have on an obstruction of justice charge or on a potential impeachment of the president. We also are going to speak a little bit later to Steven Zajcik, who is with the LA Times. He's a reporter for the LA Times, and he is covering the criminal trial of Bill Cosby, which is taking place right now, Norristown, Pennsylvania. We heard 1 week of testimony, and the second week starts on Monday. So we're going to get an up-to-date look at the Bill Cosby criminal trial from Steven Zajcik of the LA Times. Then finally, we are going to talk to Harold Gurwitz. Now, Harold Gurwitz is an attorney in Michigan, and it was determined this week that the Supreme Court is actually taking up one of his cases. And it's a very important case, because it deals with the protection of cell phone data that tracks details about where someone is with respect to a criminal matter. Now, Mr. Gurwitz represented Timothy Carpenter, who was convicted and sentenced to life in prison for robbing, of all things, cell phone stores in Michigan and in Ohio. And the question becomes, what happens when the police and the prosecution obtain cell phone data, which can help potentially convict convict Mr. Carpenter? This Supreme Court is going to talk about that as far as the Fourth Amendment goes, the Constitution, and against unreasonable search and seizures. So we're going to talk to Harold Gurwitz in our second half hour. First, we want to talk about James Comey, because that was, of course, the hot topic and still is the hot topic. I want to welcome to Gervey's Law right now Richard Druyan. He is with the firm of Shammer, Kim, and Harris. Richard, welcome to Gervey's Law.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Now, undoubtedly, you have been very involved watching the James Comey testimony this past week. Now, most people would agree that Comey's testimony in and of itself probably does not provide evidence of obstruction of justice as far as the president goes. What would you say that the net-net from the testimony will be as we move forward in continuing investigation?
Well, it's certainly going to be a subject of the investigation by Special Counsel Mueller to determine whether or not the president's conduct constituted obstruction of justice. Based upon what I heard from James Comey's testimony, I don't think it is enough for a prosecutor to bring an obstruction of justice charge, although I think you could couple all the pieces together and make an argument that would infer that he intended to obstruct the investigation. But that's something I think ultimately will be a subject of Special Counsel Mueller's investigation.
Now, Richard, we've had Alan Dershowitz on our show many times, and he has been speaking out about the concept of authority of the president to direct the FBI to stop investigating an individual, stating that under the Constitution that the president has that authority. A number of Democrats and people who disagree with that are saying, no, that Dershowitz is wrong. What is your understanding as a former federal prosecutor of the constitutional right for a president to direct the FBI in the way that apparently Alan Dershowitz has said that he can?
Well, I think the president is the head of the executive branch of the government. The attorney general reports to the president, and through the attorney general, the FBI indirectly reports to the president as well. I think the president can tell the attorney general or the director of the FBI not to pursue an investigation, and in and of itself, that action would not constitute and could not constitute obstruction of justice. But if it's coupled with other activity, it could be a part of a case of obstruction.
So when we talk about a continuing investigation, now your firm has been involved in a number of federal and state criminal investigations and prosecutions, so you have a lot of experience on sensitive investigations. What can we be looking for? Because doesn't it seem like this is being played out in the public? And I know the work that you've done in the past, I'm sure obviously not as high profile regarding the President of the United States or Michael Flynn or James Comey. So how can we expect any type of real evidence-based and consistent investigation work with respect to what we're dealing with right now?
Well, first of all, you have to have confidence in Special Counsel Mueller and his integrity, which I think he has an impeccable reputation, that he will conduct a fair and independent investigation of all of the matters related to the subject of the Russian interference in the election. And I think this is an outgrowth and it's related to that. But having said that, I don't think we're going to hear a lot about what exactly is going on in Mueller's investigation. I think it is likely that he's going to surround himself with some very experienced professional prosecutors, and I don't think you're going to see leaks from Mueller's investigation the way you've seen leaks from the executive branch and from the State Department and other departments in the government. So conducting a grand jury investigation of these various matters are going to be largely secret and kept from the public until they're over.
And that's the way it should be. But, you know, when you talk about leaks, there's been a lot of talk about James Comey leaking memos and whether or not there may be recordings. So do you think that James Comey lost some credibility when we looked at, you know, some of the pejorative things that he talked about in his testimony and the leaks of memos where maybe Mueller won't be subject to the same type of public scrutiny?
Well, certainly the president and his defenders are trying to accuse Mr. Comey misconduct in leaking information about his conversations with the president. I think you have to look at Mr. Comey's reasons for doing that, for his concern about what the president said to him, and for his desire to provoke an independent investigation by a special counsel to investigate and determine whether or not there's any wrongdoing. So I don't think Mr. Comey is a leaker in the sense of having leaked confidential information the way leaks coming out of the White House and leaks coming out of the State Department and elsewhere in the government.
Now, with Bill Clinton, we had address, and with Richard Nixon, we had tapes. From your experience, isn't it true that it's so important to have tangible evidence if they're going to be able to make these charges stick? And of course, when we're looking at criminal intent, a lot of hearsay doesn't necessarily cut it.
Well, whenever you are in conducting these kinds of investigations, you want to get corroborating evidence. If it comes down ultimately to the word of James Comey versus the word of the president, even if you believe James Comey and don't believe the president, as a prosecutor, you would be very, very reluctant to bring a one-on-one case, particularly with a beyond a reasonable doubt standard for criminal convictions. You would want corroboration, whether it's something that was written down by the president in an email or some type of a communication, or whether there were tapes. Most prosecutors would be extremely reluctant to bring a case based upon a one-on-one, particularly when you're dealing with the president of the United States.
So what would your position be with respect to a memo, for instance, that we haven't seen, or, of course, recordings? Isn't that something, as a former prosecutor, that you really would expect would have some a tangible effect? And in this case, what is your feeling of whether these types of evidence actually exist?
Well, certainly, if tapes exist, it would be the best evidence of what was said between the president and Mr. Comey. And as a prosecutor, you would absolutely want to get those tapes, just as the special prosecutors wanted to get the Nixon White House tapes, because they were the best evidence of what the president had said. Whether or not they exist, I simply don't know.
Oh, come on. You have to know that.
No. I mean, there's no way to really tell.
You're right.
The president certainly tries to hint at it. But there are a lot of things the president has said have turned out to not be true.
That's true.
So I absolutely don't have any idea whether or not those tapes exist, or whether any tapes exist.
Do you have any feel for how long an investigation like this will go? Once we've already had the James Comey testimony, and like you said, now it probably should be kind of less public, so to speak. And as we move forward, this could go on for a long time. And isn't it really just going to turn into a political event, and the actual investigation may not be as clear as testimony that we see on TV is?
Well, first of all, the investigation, I think, is going to go on for some time. It encompasses the issue of Russian interference in our election, whether or not there was any collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians, what Mike Flynn's role was, what contacts there were with Russian officials. This is going to be a very extensive investigation, and it's not going to be limited to the conversations between the president and James Comey. And as I said before, I don't think you're going to get as much insight into what's going on in Mueller's office as you get when you have congressional hearings, which are public hearings, as opposed to grand jury proceedings, which are by nature secret.
And what Alan Dershowitz said was, if there's an issue of impeachment, it's really going to come through the Congress and political avenues, not necessarily immediately through investigation or testimony, which, you know, it ultimately could. But would you agree that this is now really a political issue with all of the rhetoric and hyperbole that we are used to now hearing with this administration?
Well, if it gets, if to the extent it is now under investigation by Mueller, and the Congress is going to step back and let Mueller take the lead in conducting the investigation, I would say that that depoliticizes it. But to the extent that you are going to have public hearings before Senate or House committees, it is by nature somewhat political, although it is also fact-finding. And, you know, in the history of these kinds of hearings, there have been representatives of both parties who have shown a willingness to put politics and partisanship aside as they try to get to the truth of what happened. So the fact that it is before the Congress is by nature somewhat political, but that does not mean that you cannot put some partisanship aside and try to conduct a fair and investigation.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think there are no quick, simple answers. We're going to have to wait and see how it all plays out. Richard Druyan, thank you very much for joining us today on Gervie's Law. We appreciate all the comments.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And you are listening to Gervie's Law. We're going to be right back with Steven Zajcik from the LA Times. We're going to talk about the Cosby trial. Stay tuned.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Hey, Leanne Tweeden here. The days are getting longer, warmer, and summer's pretty much here. It's that time when everyone and everything goes crazy. And that's what happened to my sewer line. 3 hours before a dinner party, it clogged and water backed up into the sinks. Fortunately, I knew who to call. SoCal Plumbers 911, the referral service for the very best plumbers. And here's how to get in touch. Go to SoCalPlumbers911.com or call 877-PLUMBER. They're offering $50 off your entire bill just to try them out. For any plumbing problem, remember SoCalPlumbers911.com or 877-PLUMBER.
Now through June 13th, save $4 instantly when you buy selected items from favorite brands like Pepsi, DiGiorno, California Pizza Kitchen, Kellogg's, Frito-Lay, and more. Mix or match, see store or smartandfinal.com for details.
Hi, it's Dr. Leanna.
And Margaret.
Ever wonder why you are the way you are? Want to know more about yourself and your psychology? You have questions, we have answers. Tune in to On the Couch with Dr. Leanna and Margaret, Fridays at midnight, right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Love Doug McIntyre, but hate mornings. It's McIntyre in the morning, at night.
Or as I like to say, McIntyre after dark.
We told you to mark your calendars for Friday, June 9th. Well, stretch that. Move down a row and mark down Friday, June 16th from 8 to 10. That's the new date for our special McIntyre After Dark edition.
Live from the legendary, iconic, delicious Barney's Beanery at the original West Hollywood location.
Chow down on Mama's Nachos, onion rings the size of your head, and wash it all down with every beer on earth. That's McIntyre in the morning at night.
Oh, yeah.
Live from Barney's Beanery, Friday, June 16th from 8 to 10.
Only on News
Talk
Evolved.
790
KBC.
She looked at me, and this is what she said. Oh, there ain't no rest for the wicked.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
There ain't nothing in this world for free.
Yes, you are listening to Gervie's Law. I'm Alan Gervie. I'm here alone. My partner, Carrie Kasem, is out on assignment. I don't know whether she's at the Bill Cosby trial in Pennsylvania or not, but I don't think she is. Hopefully she'll come back next week. I don't know, because if we're having LeVar Ball on, I think she has a few questions for LeVar, which is our Father's Day show, and that should be interesting. But I'm going to have to proceed without Carrie. I don't know if I can, but I'm going to do my best. We are now going to talk about the Cosby criminal trial. And James Comey was not the only one testifying this week. There were about 12 witnesses testifying in the Cosby trial, I think, or maybe there were more. We'll find out from Stephen Zajcik. Stephen is an L.A. Times. He is a writer for the L.A. Times, and he has been writing some really excellent pieces on the Cosby case. Stephen, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Well, you're not really here, are you? Aren't you in Pennsylvania still, or did you come home for the weekend?
No, I'm still in Pennsylvania, suburban Philly, where if you thought the Cosby trial was a big deal back in Los Angeles, it's pretty much dominating the front pages every day here. So it's been a pretty intense time.
I can imagine. What's the feeling like inside the courtroom and outside the courtroom? You know, of course, we see a lot of supporters for Bill Cosby, and then we see a lot of supporters who are supporting women who have claimed the abuse and the assault. How do you see it?
Well, it's been interesting, and you're exactly right in terms of the supporters on both sides. You know, the first day of the trial, we had an actress who played Rudy, of course, on The Cosby Show back in the 80s, came out in support of Cosby. And then one or two days later, Louie Bernard, who had a recurring role on the show, came out to protest him, as she's been doing now for some time. So to me, that sort of encapsulated the spectrum you have. There haven't been a ton of protesters per se outside Norristown, where the trial is being held, is a little out of the way. I think a lot of people have demonstrated in the past and other maybe more central locations. But certainly in the courtroom, there's a very clear divide. Obviously, you've got, you know, on the defense side, you've got a kind of rotating group of Cosby supporters. There have been some comedians. There were some Temple trustees earlier in the week. So you've had a kind of everyone, of course, keeps waiting for other Cosby Show people, Felicia Rashad and maybe some others. And we're hearing from Cosby spokesperson that maybe we're going to get some of those or some family members. But it has been interesting. And then, of course, on the prosecution side, you have there have been a number of accusers. And Gloria Allred has been a fixture as well. She obviously represents, I think, about three dozen of the accusers. So you definitely have that split inside the courtroom.
Well, we actually learned a few weeks ago when Gloria Allred was in the studio here with me, and we did an hour with Gloria Allred. Mm-hmm. And at that time, she did hint that she would be there because one of her clients, Kelly Johnson, was actually a witness. And there were very few other accusers who were granted witness status, but apparently with Kelly Johnson, they felt that there was some similarities in the accusations. Now, speaking of Gloria Allred, and she's on our show quite a bit, so we're kind of, you know, tight. I have a problem. I should have explained to Gloria how to turn off her cell phone because when she's here with us, the cell phone's fine, but apparently she got kicked out of court because her cell phone was ringing or something.
Well, you've pretty much zeroed in on what happened. Just to give your listeners and you a bit of context here, you know, they've been extremely, as you might imagine, the decorum order and the sort of rules in the courtroom have been extremely strict. You know, there are notes allowed on electronic devices, but all Wi-Fi has to be off. No email communications. Obviously, no social media. And you know, understandably, this is an event that could easily get out of control. Of course, there are concerns about, you know, appeals down the road if, in fact, that happens. So they've been keeping a very tight lid on things. And then, of course, you know, cell phones going off just from a pure distraction standpoint can be quite disruptive. And so earlier in the week, as you kind of alluded to, it happened. Well, it's happened now twice. Gloria's cell phone and you know, Gloria and I have talked about this case quite a bit, and not as tight as you are, Alan, but quite a bit. And you know, she's been very front and center, as you say, because Kelly Johnson, who testified this week, is a client, And I think it was Monday or Tuesday, her phone went off. She was kind of gently led out of the courtroom and kind of given a warning. It's happened to one or two other people. No one, as far as I can gather in the media. It's been people in the gallery, public, members of the public, even though obviously the media does comprise most of that or a good chunk of that section. And then yesterday, her phone went off again, and she was escorted out again. And when we got back from break, we'd heard that she will now be in a what is an overflow courtroom where they're keeping right. some of some members of the public who can't get in, or some other members of the media. So she's going to be over there and not going to be in live court. Now, of course, her witness has testified already. She'll still be at the courthouse every day. She'll be holding press conferences as she does most days. But she will, in fact, someone may want to tell her, you know, that old silence function is not as hard to operate as it might appear.
Well, her daughter, Lisa Bloom, who's on our show quite a bit as well, is very savvy with social media. You might have noticed that she tweets and she's on Facebook and Instagram quite a bit. So Lisa might want to talk to Gloria about dealing with the technology of today. Let's get to some of this testimony. A week has gone by, and when you look back on the past week, what would you say was, in your view, the most compelling testimony, obviously, on behalf of the prosecution?
Well, you know, there have been a number of moments and pieces of testimony that have stood out. And you were exactly right when you said about a dozen witnesses. And we are through a week now. The prosecution rested its case late Friday. So we've pretty much gotten in. And, of course, they have the bulk of the witnesses. So we've gotten through a lot of the testimony we're going to hear. You know, I think both Ms. Johnson and Ms. Constant, Andrea Constant, the alleged victim in this case, are were very strong witnesses. I think they each told stories that narratives that really kind of went through how, in their view, they were assaulted. They were, you know, on point. They were specific, and they were compelling. You know, I think the cross-exam has got in a couple of glancing blows, perhaps, at their testimony, but it was not, you know, they were not really taken down on cross-examination. But I have to say, the witness that really stood out to me, and I think a lot of us who were in the courtroom that stood out the most, is Gianna Constant, Andrea
right.
Constant's mother, who, as I know you've been following this case and sort of know what her role is in this. And
yep.
She was not just, as you often hear in a case like this, you know, a confidant who comes in and says, well, my friend or daughter or cousin or sister was shaken. This is someone who was very central to, you know, all the interactions with Cosby when Andrew went back to her native Canada, back to be with her family after this happened. Her mother really stepped in after she found out about it and talked to Cosby. They played a phone call, in fact, of her conversation with Cosby at that point when she had found out. And she got up on the stand, and I have to say, you know, just from a purely kind of witness credibility standpoint, I think she was very cogent. She was feistier than Andrew was. Andrea, perhaps or very much understandably, was speaking from the point of view of an alleged victim. And, you know, Gianna Constant was speaking as a mom. And I think that combined with just her eloquence and her specificity on, again, she wasn't obviously there when the alleged incident happened, but she was very close with her daughter. I think a lot of people came out. Of course, we don't know what the jury thinks of all this, but a lot of us in the gallery came out feeling like she was perhaps the strongest witness the prosecution brought this week.
And one of the interesting things with her is she's actually a percipient witness. It's not a lot of hearsay because that conversation that she had with Bill Cosby was central to what would have allegedly occurred and what Bill Cosby said to her. It's kind of, I mean, folks, if you haven't seen it, read Stephen's articles. You can find them online and it takes it through. You know, this is kind of a PG show, so I don't want to get into the digital manipulation and everything that Bill Cosby was talking about. But I do want to ask you something about Andrea Constant, because before we talk more about Gianna's testimony, I'm putting on my lawyer's hat here, and also as a lawyer, we often play devil's advocate. Did it bother people when they heard under cross-examination that Andrea had, or Andrea, if you want to call her Andrea, had actually continued to communicate with Bill Cosby a number of times after the alleged incident occurred?
Well, look, that's you've really I think homed in on a key part of the defense's argument. In fact, in the opening arguments, Brian McMonagle, who's the lead defense attorney for Bill Cosby, made that point, I think the number was something around, he said there were 70-some-odd calls, just calls alone after the alleged incident, 53 of them initiated by Andrea Constantin. So that clearly is a cornerstone of the defense's argument here. What the prosecution sought to show, and I think they, you know, again, you'll sort of, we'll have to see how the jury reacts to this, but what they sought to show was that a lot of those calls, first of all, were very short in duration. We heard a lot of phone records this week, and a lot of the calls were just 1 or 2 minutes long. In fact, often 1 minute, which suggests they were not even in touch or did not even speak. They also showed the assistant district attorney who was kind of leading that charge did show that a lot of those calls came after a check of a voicemail, which suggested of Andrea's voicemail, which suggested that she was actually responding to a message from Cosby. So it was perhaps not initiating. And then, you know, the sort of final point to make on that, and this is goes to expert testimony that we heard primarily yesterday, is that, and I'm no expert on this, so I wouldn't venture an opinion on the sort of, you know, kind of credibility of the statement, but it certainly seems reasonable to me. This expert witness said that, in fact, in a lot of instances of sexual assault, particularly by a non-stranger, that there is a lot of contact afterward. And the rationale, at least one of the rationales that was given by this expert, was that the alleged victim or the victim might be trying to get back to a place where things were nice and comfortable. So I think it does definitely kind of work in the defense's favor that there was a lot of contact. If there was no contact, I think they wouldn't be able to really work that angle. But I think that the prosecution did raise a number of points that do respond to it, but certainly something that I think the defense is going to continue really trying to build upon.
We're talking to Stephen Zajcik of the L.A. Times about the Cosby criminal trial. Now, another obvious defense is going to be consensual sexual relations. And that's come up more and more throughout this testimony, at least in the first week. When we talk about that, of course, the issue of Benadryl versus Quaaludes or other medication comes up. How is that playing in front of the jury, in the audience there, with respect to whether people are believing that Bill Cosby actually was really concerned about lowering the stress level of Andrea Constantin and giving her Benadryl to relax, or whether, in fact, it was something stronger which would cause her to effectively be paralyzed and he could have his way with her?
Well, you know, that's been a very key part of the testimony this week. And when we spent a good chunk of, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday, right sort of in the middle of the week, lawyers and witnesses spent a lot of time talking about that and really debating what these pills were. Obviously, as you said, Cosby maintained in an earlier deposition that it was Benadryl. One of the points that Gianna Constantin really wanted clarified when she talked to Cosby is, what was the medication? Because she was not convinced of that. She had asked Cosby to send her the pills or the prescription or the name. He did not do that at the time. So there was a lot of ambiguity about that, and there was a big debate about what, in fact, it was. Was it Benadryl, as Cosby claimed,
right,
in the deposition, or was it something stronger? Of course, as many of your listeners know, in earlier instances, we know, and Cosby, in fact, admits in the deposition that he did buy Quaaludes to facilitate his interactions with women he wanted to sleep with. So that clearly is on the table. One thing that's interesting that came up yesterday, we heard a toxicologist. In fact, the prosecution's last witness was a toxicologist, and he made the point that, in fact, there have been a number of sexual assault cases in other places, in other instances, where Benadryl was used, often in combination with alcohol, but it was used. I think his point was that if you take one or one and a half tablets of Benadryl, it can have a deeply sedating effect.
Right.
So I think what the prosecution is kind of saying there, kind of saying to the jury is, look, you know, we've built a case for you. We've kind of created the impression here that this was stronger than Benadryl. Cosby did not say what it was. It only came out later it was Benadryl. We're going to build that case. But even if you want to believe that it was Benadryl, here's an expert saying that still does not preclude a sexual assault, that does not preclude the possibility that consent was removed, because we've seen it in other cases. So they're trying to kind of cover themselves on both sides, but certainly a big point of contention in the case.
Now, I know the judge had disallowed any issue regarding Andrew Constant's sexual orientation. Has there been any talk about, you know, whether she's gay or not and what effect that would have on the case?
There hasn't been. There's not been any intimation. I would think obviously it would be something the prosecution would want to bring up because it would potentially eliminate or reduce the possibility, at least, that they did have romantic encounters before the night of the alleged incident. The one thing I will say, and then this has been interesting, is that there really has been a lot of focus on whether, in fact, it's not been on her sexuality whatsoever, that has not come up at all, but the question of whether they were, in fact, romantic or had romantic encounters in the month leading up to that was a very clear split between the prosecution and the defense. You know, one thing that's interesting here, Alan, is that, you know, a lot of the facts or a number of the facts are not in dispute. How they met, who they met through, right, how their relationship evolved. Even, of course, the night in question, the sort of some of the contours of that night are not in question. What actually happened and whether consent was given, obviously, is what this case rests on. That's where there's deep disagreement. But one area where there is, in fact, deep disagreement on other nights and other times is, were they romantic? And you've got two very different pictures of that, depending on whether you were listening to Cosby's deposition in court this week or to Andrea Constant, because, you know, she maintained that it was a strict, you know, work/friend/mentor relationship with no possibility from her end in of romance. And Cosby's maintained they were romantic a number of times. His interest was romantic from the beginning, but they, in fact, engaged in romantic activities in the months leading up to that night. So while her sexuality has not come up, the question of whether they were romantic with each other was a big one in court this week.
And perhaps some of the testimony from Kelly Johnson and other hints of other situations of court may have an impact on that. We only have a minute or two left, Stephen. I just want to ask you, as we move forward into the second week, what do you expect to see? Obviously, the DA has rested, and we're going to hear from the defense. Are we going to hear from Bill Cosby, or what do you expect?
Well, it's going to be an interesting few days, that's for sure. We're picking up again on Monday. The defense is going to be mounting their case. They'll be bringing a number of witnesses. The feeling seems to be there will be a memory expert, obviously, there to testify that call into question Ms. Constant's ability to remember this case. There was some talk that Bill Cosby's chef, who was there, unclear what he was there for, but he was certainly there some of the times that Andrea Constant was at Bill Cosby's house. There was talk the chef might be there. We don't know that he will be, but there was talk. And then you kind of raised the elephant in the room here, which is, will Cosby himself testify? And, you know, the feeling a lot of us had, the feeling a lot of experts had, was there is no way, you know, defendants in these kinds of cases rarely take the stand. This would not be a good idea. We started to hear in this last couple of days some rumblings that maybe he will take the stand, that maybe there's some value in it. The prosecution's case has been pretty strong that maybe he will actually take the stand. A few of us reporters did talk to Andrew Wyatt, who is Mr. Cosby's spokesman, at the end of the day yesterday. He said, we're keeping our options open. We're not ruling anything out. Doesn't necessarily mean he's going to, but would it surprise me if Cosby took the stand? It would. Would it shock me, inform me? I don't think so. And so we'll see. You know, once we get through that, though, I think we're going to get to closing arguments pretty quickly. I think we could have a verdict as early as this week.
Wow. Well, we're going to stay tuned. I'll tell you, Stephen, after this whole experience is over, you might want to put all of your artists together and think about writing a book about it, because it is fascinating, and you have done a great job of covering it for the LA Times. It's Stephen Zajcik. We will check in with you, Stephen, to see what happens after this week. We appreciate all of your analysis, and thanks for being on Gervie's Law.
Excellent. Thank you again for having me.
All right. Well, we've got one more segment. We're going to bring on Harold Gerwitz after the break. We're going to talk about phone cell security and privacy rights. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Jersey Moms choose Talk Radio 790 KABC.
I'm Nick Soboleski, a SelectQuote agent with a true story that could save you hundreds of dollars a year. A woman named Linda just called. Her husband, Ray, has a $300,000 group life insurance policy, but is changing jobs and can't take it with him. Well, I impartially shopped the highly rated term life insurance companies we represent and found Ray, who is 41 and takes medication to control his cholesterol, a 10-year, $500,000 policy for under $26 a month. That's almost twice the coverage for less than half of what he had paid. If SelectQuote hasn't shopped for your life insurance, you're probably paying too much.
For your free quote, call 1-800-445-6363. That's 1-800-445-6363. 1-800-445-6363. Or go to SelectQuote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price can vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Law Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW, 855-4-RGW-LAW, or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Welcome to Geico's Motorcycle Meanderings.
Oh, man, this is great. I sure saved a lot of money by switching to Geico. I scored some big savings, and now I can use their mobile app 24-7 for all sorts of stuff. Life just makes sense now. You know what doesn't make sense? If a car is called a horseless carriage, why isn't a motorcycle called a horseless horse? Maybe it would just be adding insult to injury for the out-of-work horses.
Geico Motorcycle. Savings that make sense.
What if there was a toy store for dads? It would be called the Home Depot, where this Father's Day you can get him a new Weber Genesis 2 gas grill. Choose from 2 to 6 burners, multiple colors, and great prices starting at only $499. When it comes to great grilling, every dad deserves Weber. Doesn't yours? Be Dad's number one fan with a new grill from America's number one Weber retailer, The Home Depot. More saving, more doing. While supplies last.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Coming up on the next Drive Home with Jillian Barber and John Phillips, we'll give you an update on the trial of Bill Cosby and his googly eye.
Huh? Plus, John, a story just for us, what moderate drinking can do to your brain.
Say again. Live and local, right after Dr. Drew and Mike Catherwood, right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Very lovely.
Welcome back to Gervey's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, we're back. I'm Alan Gervey. You're listening to Gervey's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We're going to talk to Harold Gurwitz now. Harold Gurwitz is a defense attorney who represented Timothy Carpenter, of course, still represents him. Timothy Carpenter was convicted in Michigan in 2011, robbery of cell phone stores in Michigan and one in Ohio, and he was sent to prison for life. The question in the case regarded the cell phone records that were obtained by the police without a warrant and obviously contributed to the conviction. The Supreme Court of the United States is taking up the case, the Carpenter case, based on the issue of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, unreasonable search and seizures of property. Harold Gurwitz, welcome to Gervey's Law.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. Now, were you surprised this past week when you found out that the Supreme Court would be hearing your case?
I think so. It's really hard not to be surprised that a court takes so few cases and so few criminal cases that it has to be a surprise.
Now, why do you think, and that's true, I'm arguing actually in front of the Court of Appeal this week in California, and I was surprised when my writ was granted. very excited to do that. Why do you think in the Carpenter case that the Supreme Court decided that this was an issue that really needed to be determined?
I think it's really because of the prevalence of cell phones in every place in our lives. The court has looked to statistical information about how much they're used, how many people have them. And the second aspect of that is probably the kind of standards that have been used by courts. Issues like the ones that I raised in my case have been presented in other places and haven't been considered because the court has been looking to law decisions made by the Supreme Court almost four decades ago. It's time, I think, that they must have believed to update the precedent that's used to judge these cases.
Now, with your case, the Timothy Carpenter case, how did you argue the use of a warrant? Because it seems to make sense, because we use warrants for unreasonable searches and seizures in typical criminal cases that obviously don't involve the digital data and the cell phone. Why wasn't it the case that in this situation the police were required to obtain a warrant, and how difficult would that have been?
Sure. A couple brief points about the background then. One is that what's really at issue are records from wireless cell providers called historical cell site location information records. Those pinpoint exactly where cell phones are at the time they connect to the towers that we see everywhere. What the government did was use a federal law called the Stored Communications Act to obtain an order from a court based only on reasonable grounds to believe that the records would be helpful to them in an investigation. It was our position, and still is our position, that these records really constitute protected privacy interests under the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and therefore a search warrant and a standard of probable cause should have been required. And that's really what the focus, the heart of this case is about, whether or not the kind of records that are created when you use a cell phone and indicate where you're at and what you're doing, what stores you go to, when you get home, where you go to church or your doctor's office are subject to privacy protections of the Fourth Amendment.
And Edward Snowden, of course, talked about that a few years back, and it resulted in USA Freedom Act, which restricts government surveillance. Why wasn't that extrapolated for your case?
Well, our case, as I said, is really controlled by a law passed in 1986 when there were few cell phones and few cell phone towers. It's called the Stored Communications Act. It specifically says that records that are like the ones that were used in our case can be obtained either by applying to a judge for an order based upon reasonable grounds or a search warrant. It's an option that's up to the prosecutors to choose. And quite obviously, they more often choose the one with the lesser burden. That's what they did here. And we think that the court ought to reexamine this. These records have been analogized to the information on an envelope on the outside that is the address. And therefore, the court says they're just business records and don't need privacy protections. Our position is that when you put that information all together, as in Mr. Carpenter's case, where the government obtained 127 days of these records with about 102 separate data points or separate locations for his cell phone every day of that time period, that ought to be protected by the Constitution.
What was your experience like at the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals? Do you feel that there was some sensitivity to your argument?
Oh, there was indeed. We had a very good argument. One of the judges did not agree with this third-party record doctrine that I've been describing here a bit, that relates to just describing these records as business records, and said that the sheer quantity of sensitive information raises concerns that people are disclosing a good deal that's in just mundane everyday tasks, and that there needs to be a different standard used. So I think that it could be that the court thought it's time to reexamine their decisions that have been used in these cases, there are many others like ours, since the late 1980s, and see what's applicable to a digital age.
You know, there are
different times.
There are, that's true. And there are a lot of people, though, who are really pro prosecution and feel that people should not get. They shouldn't have the opportunity, like, for instance, Mr. Carpenter may have if he was protected with the cell phone data. We know that occurred last year in the 2015, actually, in the San Bernardino terrorist shootings. I represent a number of the victims of the shooting, and there was a question about unlocking the cell phones with Apple protecting their customers' privacy. How do you see this as a privacy right versus, and I know the ACLU has been involved intimately with your case, versus those saying that, hey, criminals should be put away and whatever needs to be done to do it should be done efficiently?
Well, there are two sides to this issue. I don't think either way to look at it really substantially impedes law enforcement. Really, all that we're asking is that instead of the court looking to see whether or not there are reasonable grounds, that they instead look to see whether or not there's probable cause. And because this area is really so significant, it goes not just to cell phones, but so many developing areas of our lives where people just don't understand how much is conveyed to some third-party server off in the cloud somewhere that is subject to being revealed. It's just providing a basic check on that system that says to the government, before you get my personal information, a judge ought to look to see whether or not you've got a good enough reason to do it.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. Now, do you have any idea of when the Supreme Court will hear the case, and will you be arguing before the Supreme Court?
Well, I as to the first part of that, my estimate is that it's likely to get scheduled in about November. I certainly don't know that for sure, but cert was just granted on Monday of this week, and there's briefing involved before it gets put onto the court's calendar. But I think that that is about the right time. I have done this aspect of the case along with an attorney from the ACLU Foundation in New York City, and we are joined together, and one of the decisions we're making is who's going to do the argument. We'll get there, and we're doing whatever in the best interest of our client. So that's to be determined.
But isn't that something that, you know, you've put your heart and soul in this case? Don't you think you should be arguing?
Yeah, I've been practicing a long time, and I've been looking forward to this opportunity. But we'll see. As I said, this is about getting the right result. That's what we really want here for Mr. Carpenter and for everybody who can be subjected to this kind of scrutiny from law enforcement practices that you don't even know about until right after the fact, if they make a difference like charges filed in court.
And how did you get hooked up with the ACLU? Did they come to you? Because obviously it's an issue of the interest to them.
They did, actually. They contacted me when our case was on direct appeal before the Sixth Circuit and asked if they could submit a friend of the court brief. And they did that and were really very helpful. The particular office of the ACLU that is doing this is one that has expertise in this area concerning electronic privacy. Right. So their help is really invaluable.
You know, it's interesting because we often have on our show people like Alan Dershowitz, Erwin Chemerinsky, a lot of the constitutional scholar people. We are going to follow this case. We'll talk to all the experts to see how they think the whole case will come out, especially given, obviously, the new look of the Supreme Court with Justice Gorsuch now on the court. So I don't know what effect that will have, and I'm not going to ask you that question, because I don't think you probably should answer it at this point. But I do want to wish you, Harold Gurwitz, all the best of luck as you proceed to the Supreme Court. It's a very important issue, and we'll be checking it out. Thanks for being on Gervie's Law today.